We're going to get started. Welcome, everyone. So happy that you're here. This is such a busy time, and we're delighted that you chose this workshop. This is workshop number 215, and it is Sustaining Justice Work Through Inclusive Worship. I am Reverend Kathleen Rolenz, and I am here with my co-convener, the Reverend Wayne Arneson. Where are you going, Wayne, by the way? Wait, come back. And in just a moment, we will introduce our three workshop panelists and participants. Our plan this afternoon is to have a reflective presentation from all the panelists here and some conversation back and forth within the panel, and about half of our allotted workshop time for questions and comments that expand this conversation, drawing on those of you who are in attendance today. So we're expecting a rich and vibrant conversation. Yeah, come on in. Welcome.
We're going to have to talk loudly into that mic.
Yeah, can you hear me in the back? Is that better? Yeah, good. One of the first things of, you know, meaningful, good worship, use the microphone well, right? So 10 years ago, Wayne and I were in the final stages of writing a book we called Worship That Works, which was based on our three-month road trip across the United States that we took during a sabbatical of 2005 and 2006. I'm just curious, how many of you have read the book? Yes! Thank you. Our premise at the time we wrote that book was that there had been significant changes in how evangelical and mainline Christian congregations were offering and experiencing worship. And we wanted to find out whether and how Unitarian Universalist congregations were either on or maybe behind that curve. Well, what we found out was more complicated. We learned a lot about the bones of worship, the building blocks, and the variables that make worship both the same and different from congregation to congregation, and in fact from one tradition to another. And we've learned the most about what worship means to Unitarian Universalists and the role that it plays in our lives. So this year we were happy to be asked to create a second edition of Worship That Works because it has continued to be read and used, especially by lay worship committees and worship associates teams and by students preparing for the ministry. So this opportunity to create a second edition gave us a chance to not only revise the book, but to add new material. So up to a third of the content of the book is new material. We've just finished copy editing the process, and the new book will be available for purchase in September 2017. Shameless commerce commercial here. The posters that Skinner House created for us is an advertisement for that new edition. So one of the areas in our book that we realized needed the most updating from when we wrote it in 2000, it was published 2007, was in the chapter that we wanted to retitle, Inviting and Including All People. 10 years ago, this was essentially a chapter about trying to do multicultural worship while avoiding cultural misappropriation. And we realized that so much has happened in 10 years in our own consciousness of worship and of worship's role in our lives and in the way that multicultural worship is no longer a niche service, but a foundation to our spiritual lives as Unitarian Universalists.
Most Unitarian Universalist congregations have included in their mission statements a commitment in some form to justice work or service that is promoting justice work. So ours is a faith that sees salvation not as simply personal, but as collective, and that seeks salvation not from the flames of a mythical hell, but from the despair of everyday hell that humans create through racism and through oppressive systems that sustain the power of elites. As awareness of our social location within white supremacy culture expands within Unitarian Universalism, our commitment to multicultural engagement and awareness has moved from being one of our social justice programs to, which is the way I think we experienced it a decade ago, to a missional and foundational commitment. So if we take this missional commitment seriously, then it must be expressed in how we worship for many reasons. Worship is the most visible part of what we do and the first thing usually that somebody wanting to check us out sees. It's our first chance to engage with a new person who walks in the door. And it is the heartbeat of the living, beloved community in each of our congregations. And so if our worship does not express this missional commitment, we really don't have it. We want to express three reasons with metaphors for how worship works to support our spiritual lives as social activists and people committed to anti-oppression work. And so we have asked our panelists not necessarily to feel obligated to reference these metaphors. They're going to go in some different directions. But Kathleen and I thought we would throw these out for to get you thinking about these issues. We see worship in the context of the theme of this workshop as a body, as a blanket, and as a blaze. So we got three B words here that we want to unpack. Body, blanket, and blaze.
These metaphors came to us when, as Wayne and I were processing the experience that I had this year in participating in one of the most inspiring and dramatic social justice movements that I've ever experienced. And that was the stand taken by the youth of the Sioux tribes at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline, which was a public witness and social movement that drew support from around the world. Now, most of you have heard about that this encampment of witness, originally started by youth, grew into a larger camp that was supported by elders, that was grounded in spiritual values and daily, regular worship through more than a year of struggle. And there were many setbacks. And, of course, the winter set on, so it was very cold. And ultimately, the encampment of witness won the day in securing a delay and a review of the pipeline. The battle was lost during the federal election. There's now news for hope. But what I remember on those cold nights when ceremonies were held, the ceremonies, of course, were quite different from UU services held in comfortable sanctuaries. But I could nevertheless see that all this sustaining worship shared those three evidence very much, those three elements that were very much in evidence on the South Dakota prairie that winter: gathered bodies, warm blankets, and a blazing fire.
Worship that sustains us for the work of justice will always embody not only who we are together, but who we honor and miss that we feel connected to, but whose bodies may not be present, and who we want to become, that is the larger body that we aspire to be. So the metaphor of worship as our body is very important for social justice work. Worship asks us to be present with our whole bodies, no matter what their size, their color, their ability, so that we can share together the inspiration of words and music and rituals to show us who we are together, beyond the limits of space and time that all of our bodies must live within. Our worship must embody our highest aspirations. And so frequently in Unitarian Universalism over the past 10 years, the words, the gestures, the authors, the cultures that we include in our worship have been a focus for challenges and questions about whether we are actually creating and honoring the body that we want to become. This is as it should be. If worship is as important to us as we think it must be, then worship should be a place in our congregational life where challenge and change and self-reflection are all a part of our worship engagement.
The blankets that kept people warm as they gathered for ceremonies at Standing Rock were critical to being able to participate. But as a metaphor, those blankets help us remember that worship is a source of comfort, of warmth, and even healing as we seek refuge, rest, and recovery from the emotional and physical challenges of seeking justice. So everyone who participates in social activism needs to come in from the cold sometimes to seek shelter and to be nourished and replenished in a place of safety. The word sanctuary is often applied to our places of worship, and the word refuge is not uncommon when people describe what they find in their Unitarian Universalist worship. Doing justice work is sustainable when we can also wrap ourselves in that blanket of our common worship and rest.
The central fire in the ceremonies at Standing Rock is represented in a small but powerful way by the lighting of the chalice that is a part of most Unitarian Universalist worship services. Paraphrasing what we often say, we light the chalice for the body of truth, the blanket of community, and the blaze of commitment. That fire of commitment is the blaze within us that does have to be constantly stoked to sustain a long-term missional commitment to social justice and to anti-oppression work. Sometimes the logs that get thrown on that fire are victories that we can celebrate when we know that our witness has made a difference. But in times when we suffer setbacks and defeats, that blaze needs to be rekindled with those small sticks of poetry and song, of ritual and recitation, so that we remember again who we are and where we have been and what remains possible for us to do together. We are so grateful to three colleagues who have responded to our invitation to share some of their own reflections about the ways that our worship must be engaged with to be sustaining over the long haul for anti-oppression and justice work. And they each represent in their own ministries and leadership in diversity of ways the body of Unitarian Universalism and the leaders that sustain us in our quest. Introducing them alphabetically by first name is the way I guess I did this. Reverend Dr. Hope Johnson, on my left at the end of the table, is the minister of the UU Congregation of Central Nassau in Garden City, New York, and a congregational consultant with the Central East Region. Reverend Josh Pollock is the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut. He's just finished a four-year term on the UUMA board. Reverend Teresa Inez Soto is the interim minister of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Flint. So I'm going to offer each panelist a chance to offer some reflections, and then we're going to do some back and forth among the five of us for a little bit, and then throw it open for your questions at the microphone in the middle of the room. And I believe that Hope is going to go first. Thanks, Hope.
So what drew me in when I walked into when I entered my first Unitarian Universalist congregation was a bunch of banners representing all kinds of religions, and I immediately felt at home. The welcome, just that unspoken welcome, meant the world to me. Thank you. Each service has its own components. I started off in the summer, so it was a more relaxed service than usually takes place during the year. But most of the Unitarian Universalist services that I have experienced have been pretty much the same, have a lot of the same components, and you know what to do. You know where you fit in and all of that. So let me approach it a little differently. What mattered to me, aside from those beautiful banners, was the welcome that I received. I was truly, truly warmly welcomed. Each time I went to my little congregation, I was welcomed. And with time, as I became a leader and found my voice, I was asked to do a lot of pulpit supply. This was before I was a minister, and I had time to go out there and speak. And each time, I received what I knew was a warm welcome. But let me tell you what it included. It included the song, No More Auction Block for Me. I don't know if you know the words of that song, but it talks about, I will never be on an auction block again. And for me, based on who I am, my perspective was as a woman of color who would have been on the auction block being sold. Now, I tell you, I do know that the welcome was meant to be warm and sincere, but it hurt. There's another song. Many of you know it, so I've asked my buddy Josh to lift his voice in song, and let's join in.
Not sure why she asked.
Oh, freedom.
And I'm soloing on this?
No, I'm with
okay.
you. Okay. We're all going to do this.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my
So imagine, that's the welcome I get. Now, I'm looking at a sea of practically white folk singing to me that there'd be no more auction block and that, oh freedom, before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave. And I'm thinking, there's something wrong with this picture. But because of that blaze that Wayne and Kathleen talked about, that spark of love in my heart, I just knew that the intention was positive, though the impact did not feel welcoming to me. And I share with you, with permission, something that happened and why I do believe in the power of worship, going over it again and again to make it better. My colleague, Reverend Ian White Marr, was with me in New York, and he said, Hope, we're going to do this song, No More Auction Block. We're going to do Oh Freedom. And I said, Ian, we really can't. You know how much I can't stand it. I just can't do this. And he said, trust me, we can. When time came for our presentation, there was Ian in a top hat, tails, with a lash, a whip, whatever. And I'm thinking, dude, what is wrong with you? But you know what he did? He took the role of the auctioneer, and he said, I will never, ever stand on an auction block again. And I will never be part of that system. And he threw everything off, and it was the first time I could sing those two songs. I share that to say that it was through the experience of worship time and time again that things were able to reach a better, more inclusive place in our worship. And what started at my congregation, the Community Church of New York, we've since talked about this and shared it. So it's a different welcome that people often who look like me get. The other thing that's happened is I can talk about it and say, what are you offering as an opening hymn? What is the music like? Where's the balance between the readings and the music? What are the symbols of diversity, multiculturalism? What are all of those symbols that you're weaving in on a day when I'll be there and on a day when I will not be there? And so I want to end this particular part of it with, and thank you, Josh, for raising the song, the importance of setting the context. I have found over these years, if there's something that doesn't quite work with me, I can say so. I can bring it up in the hope that those with whom I'm working will allow me that space to use it as a teachable moment. So we'll talk further from there.
All right, first, thank you to Wayne and Kathleen for the invitation to be here. And it's awesome to be on a panel with Hope and Teresa, two people I admire greatly. I think the reason I was invited has to do, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but it has to do with something that happened at the ministry days last June. And before I tell that story briefly, let me just say this. The blanket metaphor makes a lot of sense to me. Certainly in the congregation that I serve, there are people who hear the church calling them to be involved in a whole range of social justice and environmental justice work. And then there are people who hear calls perhaps from other places in their own life just to be engaged in work, say the work they do for a living, that is service work, that is work that cares for people and work that tries to achieve a more just and loving community. So when they come to worship on Sunday morning, it is one of those moments where that image of wrapping a blanket around them and just sustaining them through the warm welcome, through the nurturing words, the nurturing music, that's a really important metaphor. And I think the need for such a blanket is never more greater for Unitarian Universalist clergy than when we arrive at ministry days after a long year of working and ministering, often in very difficult situations. And last June, I was working on a team that had responsibility for the opening worship on Tuesday morning. And we were talking about race and racism, but we were doing it through the use of a story from the Bible when Peter gets out of the boat and walks on water. And although it's a very useful metaphor, we kept using it. We kept talking about getting out of the boat and walking. And we kept singing about walking and guide my feet and one more step. And it just went on and on and on. And a lot of people really loved the worship. And a lot of people were really hurt because that blanket had not been wrapped around them. This is people in particular who may not walk as easily as many of us, or may not walk at all, may use a scooter or a chair to get around. They didn't feel welcome. They didn't feel included. And we heard the criticism immediately. Teresa was one of the people who helped bring that criticism. And realized we missed the mark. So there's a story that goes along with that about how we offered an apology and how the UUMA now is actually doing an ableism audit and has an ableism task force, and that's fascinating work, and we hope it's really fruitful work. But it was a great reminder and a great learning moment that the words and the metaphors we choose may exclude more than they include, and just because the metaphor works for me doesn't mean it's going to work for everybody. So I preached on this in October, and some of the issues that come up in that sermon, but I think come up whenever we talk about being intentional about the words and the metaphors we choose, and making sure that they aren't harmful, that they do offer a welcome that is as broad and as inclusive as possible. Some of the criticisms that come up are, this sounds like political correctness. This is a road to censorship. What's next? We're not going to be able to see, we're not going to be able to hear, we're not going to be able to walk. What's next? When you, sometimes in churches, but often on college campuses when we're having this conversation, we're hearing about this intellectual fragility. What, you can't be around a concept, an idea that rubs you the wrong way? Isn't that what we want? Isn't that what our faith is all about? Being able to be around ideas that challenge us, perhaps words that challenge us. But I think there's a really important distinction to make. There's a difference between an idea or a word or a metaphor that challenges us and one that hurts. And what I've been preaching about back in October and really since then is, let's err on the side of compassion. When we're thinking about the words and the metaphors we're going to use, let's err on the side of compassion. Let's not even, you know, if we know something is harmful, if we know that too many references to brothers and sisters is going to start making transgender people and gender nonconforming people feel like there's no place for me here, if we know that body metaphors will make people with disabilities feel unwelcome, let's not use them. Now, some people will call that censorship. I call it an opportunity for growth. Why? If we know the body of music that we have access to has limits, why aren't we writing new songs? Why aren't we seeking out new metaphors? I think it's an opportunity, and very grateful to have that opportunity. One other thing I'll end with is that when I talked about our experience at Ministry Days in my sermon in October, a couple people who have trouble or can't rise as they are able said, you don't have universal design in worship. If we have to rise for every hymn, then there's always a way in which we're a second-class citizen, even though you're giving us permission to not rise. Why do we have to rise for every song? People sing seated all the time. Why can't we be seated for some of this? So we've done worship where we never rise, right? And minimally now, we rise for some of the songs and not for all of them. So it was good. It was good to put out an idea and have that come back to me and realize right then and there a way we could actually change our worship so that it's more inclusive and does less harm.
You don't mind if I do a little of the background work, right? When we're talking about ableism, I want to be really clear that ableism is an unexamined system of beliefs that places a high value on able bodies and low value or no value on disabled bodies. You can see that I place a certain amount of value on my body. Oh, well, I don't know. Maybe you can't. I think, and I tell this to congregations, that I'm adorable and they're lucky. But I'm really not kidding. Like, there's a way in which I'm not supposed to know that about myself because I'm disabled. So when we come to the worship context, I'm really grateful for Hope's story, and I'm really grateful for Josh's story. And Josh is saying, we should extend compassion, right? And I'm here to tell you a little bit about the compassion that disabled people can extend for you. Because you don't know what you don't know until you know it. So I want to take a few moments to read to you from Laura Hershey, who was an ancestor in this disability activism. And this poem of hers is called "You Get Proud by Practicing." She says, "You can add your voice all night to the voices of 150 others in a circle around a jailhouse where your brothers and sisters are being held for blocking buses with no lifts. Or you can be one of the ones inside the jailhouse, knowing the circle outside. You can speak your love to a friend without fear. And you can find someone who will listen to you without judging you, or doubting you, or being afraid of you. And let yourself be heard for the very first time. These are all ways of getting proud. None of them are easy, but they are all possible. Those are things you wouldn't know about if no one told you. You wouldn't know about the disabled people who climbed up the steps of the U.S. Capitol in order to push forward the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And you don't know about the people who are waiting and hoping that they can come to community, but your church isn't ready, right? So when we talk about these adjustments, sometimes people will say, well, Teresa, it's just a metaphor. And actually, I completely realize that, right? Like, I'm a poet, I know about that. The reason you use the metaphor is because it's powerful. And as long as you are invested in the idea that able bodies have lots of value and other bodies don't have that much value, then you can stack your metaphors in that direction without being burdened. You get that? So when we talk about making these adjustments, there's a whole sphere of people who are looking for you. Does that mean we can never sing "Guide My Feet"? No, it doesn't. But what it does mean is that when you sing it, it might behoove you to take the 10 seconds to say, hey, we're about to sing about feet and stuff. Right? The walking, the journey. But there are people for whom that's not a principal spiritual practice. If you have a lot of video gamers in your congregation, that might be a great proportion of the people. It's not even special like that. But in order for worship to expand, we really have to put some energy and interest there. And I think we can do it, but we have to intend to. So for me, I've had the experience of getting on the bus to go to my church, riding an hour and a half, and getting there and having the accessible entrance be locked, right? And sitting out on the sidewalk and finding a stranger and pulling on their sleeve and saying, are you going in there? Can you tell the usher I'm waiting out here? Like, I was a member there. I was an RE teacher there. I was doing the things. And what they said was, if we knew you were coming, we would have unlocked the door. But it's not them. You need to know. You would make that mistake. Right? You would make that mistake if you weren't thinking about who's looking for you. And that compassion is still there. It goes both ways. You don't have to be perfect to be awesome, right? But you have to unlock the door. Yeah. Yeah. So I want you to know that sometimes people get really overwhelmed because they think, oh, well, we don't have money for an elevator. Did anyone ask you for an elevator? Like, maybe you just need to unlock the door. Right? I mean, we laugh about it because we're like, oh yeah, I should have thought of that. But it's all so real. You get that, right? Yeah, it's okay. We're going to make mistakes. But doing nothing because you're afraid of making a mistake is not that good. You can do better. So I just want to encourage us that there is compassion to go both ways, courage to go both ways, investigation to go both ways. What if we're doing stuff in worship that nobody likes? Yeah, we might uncover some of that and be able to leave it behind. I really believe in us as the people who can find the people who are waiting for them and make a spot. And what I tell people in my congregation is that what I want them to know and their friends to know is that we're saving a seat for them. The only thing we're adding here is that if the people you're saving a seat for are people with disabilities, you might have to make more room. You might have to do something. But it's not beyond your power. It's not beyond your interest. It's not beyond your benefit. So it's okay. That's all for me.
So our panelists have really expanded the scope of what it means to talk about embodied worship as a sustainer of our social justice life by recognizing that first, to have embodied worship, everybody's body needs to be able to actually get into the room to participate and to engage in ways that feel comfortable and appropriate to them. So that's one layer of worship extending beyond the boundaries of 11 o'clock and to 12 o'clock on Sunday morning or whenever you do it, and the walls of the sanctuary. If there's somebody sitting outside the door and can't get in, there's something else happening with worship that belies who we are. Similarly, if you articulate all sorts of high values and principles and desires in worship, but the bodies in the room actually don't go out after 12 o'clock into the world and make those values real, there's something false about the worship. So we're talking here about authenticity in how we embody our worship. And much of this conversation, I think, has been, well, it's been on, both on the inside of the sanctuary and also on the outside. I want to also raise the possibility that some of you might want to respond to imagining worship embodied as involving all of our senses and capacities, so that there are so many ways in which worship life and the metaphors of worship can be expressed in a diversity of ways, different ways that come from different cultural traditions, not just in words, but in images, in music, in forms of movement, in ritual, so that all of the senses become engaged. And I wanted to see if these comments bring up anything for you on the panel, conversationally, about either a story or ways in which you think as worship leaders about full embodiment of that 1 hour experience of worship outside the sanctuary, before and after the service happens, and inside the service, so that it really fully represents who we are. Does that question make sense?
It does make sense, and I don't know if I'm the best person to respond with a lot of examples, but I've heard the critique of Unitarian Universalist worship ever since I began imagining myself as a worship leader, that our worship, at least historically, and I think there's still some truth to it today, is very much in the head. I don't imagine this is a news to anyone here. So how do you move as a worship leader or worship designer, move worship beyond the head? And I think there's a lot of ways to do that. I'm always impressed when I'm attending a worship service, participating in a worship service, and the whoever has designed it has paid very close attention not only to the words that are being said, but to how bodies are moving or expected to move in the service, what is being heard, what is being smelled, the aesthetics. I'm a person who can't look at a room and tell if it looks right in terms of the colors or I mean, I can tell if the pulpit is centered in the middle of the room, but I think, Wayne, that's what I'm hearing you get at, is to what extent are aspects of the body other than the mind being ministered to? And I will say I find it difficult. I always think I do a much better job when it's not me and it's a we, when we've got a team and there are people on the team who feel things in a different way than I do, or have different aesthetic expectations, or have a sense of what's possible in a space. Like, how can we configure the space? And our worship space, it does not have pews, so we actually can do a lot in terms of how we configure the space. And I do think when you are able, well, I guess there's two things that occur to me. One is there are people who just really feel that blanket when they come in on Sunday morning, and it's the same way it's always been, because it is comforting to them. And then there are others who need something different. So if there's been a lot of preaching in recent weeks, let's get away from preaching. Let's do more singing. Let's do some kind of easy movement in the room. Let's have a slideshow. It's definitely a growing edge for me. You may be able to tell that in the way I'm talking about this. So, other thoughts?
So one thing I've appreciated about getting married this year is that I married a fantastic preacher. And one of the things that Sean Dennison says is that the children's story is the first sermon illustration. And that is so fantastic for me to think of, because I can build in a story that has a refrain that we can all repeat together, or a joke that we can refer to later, or stories are all different, have a lot of features. But that's one thing that I would say, as I practice it in the service and make sure that it sort of is the first bookend in the lesson part of the service, that really helps me be able to tie things in. And also, I told you that I write poetry, so I have at times written a short song, the words, I paid somebody to do the music part, that we can repeat for the theme of the month. So if we're doing Soul Matters or Faith Rocket, we match the verse or the content to the theme and then repeat that every week. And part of the reason to do that is to continue the conversation. So those are two things that I do to add another layer of whatever we're talking about, but not just with words, also with some other texture.
And all I can add is that it's a growing edge for me as well. I am learning, but through thematic preaching, in other words, I have a team approach to it with my our director of music, with our director of religious education. We all have the same theme for a particular service. And we find different ways to work that theme. and it might include the music, it might include some kind of movement, even if it's we come from the mountains, you know, some hand movements, or sometimes it's dance, which is new for me personally. The other thing, so I've been working on that, and the other thing is we like what Josh was saying, we stopped asking people to rise in body or in spirit for our hymns several years ago, and it's made such a difference. But it came with a little struggle, but it's made such a difference. The other thing I do that I consider to be part of embodiment, Wayne and Kathleen, is I make a way for people to communicate with each other during every single service. If it's only to say, hi, I'm Hope, and I'll say, go find someone new whom you've never met. Go find someone who you haven't seen in a long time, and that's part of it. And some people, I might go to you. You might come to me. But that's another way of bringing in that embodiment that you speak of. And then we sort of quiet it down and get into worship mode together.
One of the things that really inspired us during our travels and then in doing the second edition was to realize how much worship is evolving and continuing to evolve, and how some other denominations are doing things, you know, wildly experimental that we haven't even imagined. In fact, on the way over here, I was just reminded of a worshiping community that we haven't visited but read about, and their entire worship service is built around food. It's all built around the communion table, but it's not just wafer and wine. It's literally the entire congregation creates a meal, a shared meal, and creates their entire liturgy around that shared meal with the premise that just as food feeds our bodies, so does the spirit feed our souls, so does the community feed our lives and our ability to go out into the world and perform and do works of social justice. So I think it's really exciting, and I think, you know, Unitarian Universalism has changed so much from when I first entered, when it was in the 80s, which it was what we called the hymn sandwich. That was the standard by which, and you could pretty much find that in every Unitarian Universalist congregation. And I also know that there's fear of loss. As we continue to evolve and continue to expand and be more inclusive, so that that welcome includes all, there's also the fear that what I found and was dear to me and important and precious will somehow be lost. And part of our argument in the book is, no, we can have it all. It's about skillful means. It's about taking the time. It's about reflecting. It's having a team of people to constantly ask questions. Why do we do this? And to hear the criticism as well, and to respond to it. Just as, you know, Josh, you were talking about last year's General Assembly, and some of the ways that, as painful as that was, were different as a result of that. Thank you, and thank you. So I'm aware that there's a whole room full of folks here who participate in, whose primary spiritual practice, or one of their primary spiritual practices, is going to a worship service. And so I wanted to leave some time, we wanted to leave some time to also hear from you about what is it about your worship experiences that have been transformative, and because we've tried to connect this to social justice, how has your worshiping community and worship life enhanced, supported, sustained your work with social justice, whether it was working with other bodies, whether it was being able to put on the blanket for a little while to be warmed, whether or not it was gathering around the fire and receiving sparks of inspiration from that fire in your worship life. So I'd really love to hear from some of you as well. And there is a microphone, yes, in the center. So do state your name and the congregation where you are, where you're from, or any other comments you might have about your worship life.
Hi, all. My name is Catherine, and I'm actually going to turn like this.
Thanks, Catherine.
Because even though I appreciate so much you taking the time to speak to us, there's more of you out here. In addition to being a member of First Parish Dorchester in Boston, Massachusetts, I'm also a founder slash resident of Margaret Mosley Cooperative, which is a new cooperative of the Unitarian Universalist Community Cooperatives that just opened in October. So that's exciting. But I kind of wanted to offer a reframing around inclusivity in music and worship that I partially on my own experience and personal revelations, and also informed by history. So the congregation I belong to, although it's in a very predominantly POC community, is majority white. And so at first when I got there and I felt frustrated by the overwhelmingly European music, I was talking about how we needed to be inclusive and welcoming to POCs in the neighborhood who might want to come. And then I thought about it and I was like, no, this music is also not feeding me as a white woman. and I thought about it and I was like, you know, a lot of what's categorizes European music is very cerebral, but also very individualistic. You listen to it as an individual to gain individual peace. And the power of music cannot be underestimated in terms of bringing communities together and binding communities. And if you think historically about people of all colors, regardless of where they're from, we all have this. This is all of our birthrights and heritage. Before the Catholic Church rolled over Europe, that's what Europeans were doing too, right? Doing a more participatory and dance-filled musical experience. And I think if we're about community and building community and building community that goes deeper than an interrogation of semantics, but like we can rely on one another and we can release all the BS that we endure going through the week, no matter what we look like, but because of the powerful forces in our society, then we need that to like be a true community. So I think if we can get away from the like European or white black dichotomy and just think of we all need this. We all need this as humans if we're gonna go beyond the individual level of peace and reflection that some of the music that has historically been in UU services, we all need more than that. And then also historically, when you look at people that have overcome dominant forces through revolt or whatever else, they come through a very active music and dance, right? An example I always think of is the Haitian Revolution, which sparked the first independent black republic and the first enslaved people of African descent to get freedom. And, you know, the life expectancy in what is now Haiti leading up to the revolt was about 5 years once people got there. That's how cruel it was and how horrible it was. And that led to people being brought, you know, constantly from all over. And so how did these people come together? These people that spoke different languages were from different part of the continent. It was around the drum and the dance. And that's what gave them the power to come together. And so I think of that often when I think of what we need more of in our congregation. So I just wanted to offer that.
I think so. I'll turn around. I'm Mary Gibb. I'm a member of the Boulder Valley UU Fellowship in Lafayette, Colorado. I belonged to a church 20 years ago that was building its choir, and we practiced really hard for some Bernstein piece or something that we were going to do for the whole congregation. And in the week before, several people ended up on crutches, and I myself fractured a bone in my foot. And we suddenly realized we couldn't get to the front of the congregation to sing. So ever since then, I've been really, really conscious of people who may want to sing in the choir, but they can't get up front to where the choir is singing. Fortunately, in that congregation, we moved the grand piano. We created a hall or a sort of a little alleyway where people could go to get up to the front. But otherwise, there were three steps that had to be climbed. And I think there are probably a lot of people who don't sing in the choir because they can't get up to the place where the choir is singing. And I think that's a really important thing to consider.
first off, my name's Steve Pearsall, and I'm from the Greensboro Unitarian Universalist Congregation, North Carolina. And the microphones, you guys are absolutely right to encourage people to do that. I can be heard without a microphone very easily, and I have to remind people in my congregation all the time to use the mic, because it's a true accessibility issue. What I wanted to ask the three of you, and you two as well, is I get to craft a worship once every year or two, and since I'm not the settled minister, I can do things that tweak the congregation a little bit when I do that, that can be unsettling. For example, Josh mentioned moving the chairs around. Very first service I ever did, I put the whole place in a circle. You never saw so many people uncomfortable when they walked in. I can't sit in my regular seat. What am I going to do? And the nature of the service was such, though, that I wanted them to think from a place of discomfort a little bit. And the other piece of it, besides that I've used quite a bit when I am the one organizing a service, is play acting, or like actors' theater. So you have several people, several voices, not just mine. And we're all involved somehow in doing the worship. It can even be something as simple as a reading that's got multiple parts. Instead of just doing call response, have different people in different parts of the room each read a section. There's all sorts of things like that you can do. So I'd love to hear what you guys think of that.
I've got one response. You know, one of the things that I have always felt about worship services that are innovative in their design of how the room is arranged, or just use something different that the congregation isn't used to, is that you have to remember to keep the blanket element somewhere in the service that allows for regular things that frame the service, like the chalice lighting, or maybe prayer, or something the congregation knows by heart, or a familiar song that's always sung, so that there are those markers that people recognize as home for them, the worship as a home place. So in talking about ways that we innovate, worship conversation can be a real focus for where my comfort zone is and what makes me feel at home in the congregation. So I just would say respect the ways that the blanket works, even as you innovate and even as you change the service in ways that try to be more inclusive and try to invite and welcome many more different kinds of people. Other comments to that
one? I was just going to say that we, when I started off, we used to have joys and sorrows, and okay, that was a big thing in itself. But anyway, one day this member of the congregation gave the most horrific soliloquy against people of a particular religion. And I did the clearing of the throat, I did the hand on the shoulder, nothing worked. After the service was over, I said, you know, we need to talk. What would it take for you to have spoken about something positive? Take all that negative energy and put it into something positive. And I said, could you come up with a peace candle lighting where you are wishing peace on all, and where you are also stating your intention to be a peacemaker? Otherwise, we're going to have to turn to this disruptive policy book. And he said, give me a week or two, and I'll come up with something. And I trusted that he would. Let me just say that I am now in my 14th year. We have a peace candle lighting where different members and friends of the congregation speak each week and light a candle of peace for the world. So it means also being responsive when you see a need. It doesn't mean storming out, let's have a petition, let's kick this person out. It might mean let's figure out what caused this to happen and what can we do about it as a community to make things better. And so I just share that as something that worked for me. And Teresa, you had some.
When I got to Flint Church, people would come to the front of the sanctuary and light candles one at a time, pretty much the way you've been coming one at a time to the microphone. And for a variety, or at least a handful of reasons, I wanted to be able to expand that candle lighting. So now, in the back of the sanctuary, we have candles on risers, where there's lots of rows and lots of space. That's where the book is to write. And so that happens in the back. And you can still go to the front also. And that's important to people because there's a way that they check in with each other about who goes to the front and what's going on for you. And it's just part of the culture. And that's fine. But having it in the back also has helped. So that's a way that we just added more. We didn't make a huge change. And more people are able to participate in the way that fits their needs.
The most transformative thing for worship for me wasn't something that happened in front. It was what happened inside of me. And it was when we had called our new minister, and who was actually a friend, and couple weeks after she was there, she said, you know, you're kind of one of those people who, you know, sits back and impress me. And she asked me to lean in, to see myself as a participant in that service, that I wasn't just taking stuff in. It has made a huge difference. And I think one of the things that made that possible was because my minister saw what she was doing up there was having a conversation. She was not talking at us. She was in a conversation with us. So I guess I would invite, I think I've heard a lot of stories already, and I want to hear more stories about how you make sure that the conversation includes everyone.
I just wanted to respond to that. I mean, certainly the creation of the Worship Associates, Worship Leaders Program that many of us have is my favorite way of creating worship so that it includes not just my voice, but the voices of members of the congregation. And if they're not the ones that are physically up there preaching or participating in the liturgy, it's the conversations before we create worship that makes this truly feel like a conversation, because to me that's the best worship of all, that it feels like we are in this wonderfully large conversation. It's a conversation writ large through the use of music and poetry, language, history, the arts, and so that to me is how liturgy functions, and it's you know, it's a great privilege to be able to do that. I don't know if anyone on our panel would like to respond to that question before we go to another one.
Michael, I don't know if this is exactly the kind of leaning in you're talking about, but in the church in Manchester, Connecticut, we have one of the ways we share ministry is I'm a full-time minister. I only preach twice a month, so we have lay-led worship the other two Sundays, and it means what it means in practice is that a lot of lay people are participating in the leading of worship. And one of the ways they do it, a coordinator of a service, a lay coordinator, will have an idea they want to explore in the service, and they'll go to three or four different people, hopefully as diverse a group as possible, and say, be on a panel. So come in, have 2 or 3 minutes or 4 minutes of reflection on this one particular question. And so they weave these three or four people in across the hour of worship, so you get multiple voices. But through the course of the year, there's probably about 100 different people who will speak from the pulpit on a Sunday morning. I like asking, I will do this too, so I might have a topic I want to touch on, I want to explore, and I'll get three or four people to write 3 to 4 minutes of material, and then I'll take it, and most people when they write will have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I sometimes, if you can get the, I can get the get it so that all their beginnings are spoken, and then I'll say something, it'll be music, and then all their middles are spoken. So there's this arc to worship and all these multiple voices. The one we just did that I really liked in April for Passover, I asked 3 different Jewish people in the congregation to reflect on what it meant as a child to have bitter herbs on the Passover plate, the maror. What did that mean to you as a child? And so the stories that came out were both, there were some similar themes, but then some real distinction. And it's just a wonderful way for people to lean in, or at least to be invited to lean in. We say every Sunday, each of our lives tells a story that is worth hearing.
And then something very practical, or some practical ideas. The children, the young people who are part of the service, really don't send them out as if you can't wait for them to leave. I mean, that's just something I have seen happen so often. So we need to shift that paradigm. Allow opportunities for speaking with each other. Be very invitational about that, and maybe if you've started a conversation, carry it forth during your coffee hour or whenever, but just always leave space for the continuation of the dialogue. And also to pay attention to how the place is decorated. It's a small thing, but if you don't pay attention to the little special thing that's up there, the special order of service, the something special that makes the theme something you'd want to lean into. That's just a practical way of working on that and embodying it in a different sense.
I think we've got time for one more speaker, one more question, and you've been waiting, right, at the back?
Actually, Josh.
Who is it?
That's what we do in our congregation, so that's what I've been doing.
Okay. Anybody else? Am I asking you, or have you been waiting? You stood up. Go for it. While you're coming up, you know, there's a lot of different, we've been thinking about how to bring voices of people of color more to the front and to the center of our conversations. There's a lot of ways to do that. And your idea, Josh, was in a sense one way. Interview people in the congregation who represent diversities of experience about the sermon theme that you're working on. It's a little different way for ministers to approach their sermon construction and bring those voices forward.
Stand here.
Oh,
and face
goodness.
Me. There you go.
Whew. Okay. That's a little more terrifying. So I'm Nicole. I'm from La Crosse, Wisconsin. My first comment was about the chairs. It was not on my radar until I recently completed our AIM certification, but we have a few members of our congregation who have sort of debilitating PTSD, and not having their chair against the wall where they can, like, see the exits was very traumatizing for them. So just something I hadn't thought about. I'm an occupational therapist. Like, accessibility is my thing, and that was not on my radar at all. So just something to think about there. Inclusion. I guess I'm looking for input on a different sort of inclusion. Multi-generational services, children being involved, that's sort of my spearhead campaign. I just joined the board because I feel like this is a big issue in my congregation, as well as different religious beliefs. The congregation I currently go to is very small, and they're very much coming from that intellectual lecture perspective, and we have a consulting minister who's really pushing that comfort zone, which is wonderful. But, like, anytime she mentions God or Christianity, everyone, like, really tenses up. And I'm sure a lot of you are probably have been or are in one of those congregations as well. So just helping to ensure everyone's spiritual needs are being met, and stepping away from this we're not Christian to me, having been a UU my whole life, if you claim to be a UU, you need to accept that history too, and that Christianity is part of our history as Unitarian Universalists. So before I pass out, I'm gonna go away.
I am so grateful for that comment. Thank you so much, because it's constant in our congregations. I would say, for one thing, I normalize Christianity. I always put it in. I also put it in context, and I also try and provide other language. And I've served. I'm a UU Christian, an out UU Christian, and I've served in primarily humanist congregations. And there's always concern and fear at the beginning that what their understanding of Christianity is not my understanding of Christianity. And so I think part of it is, again, going back to context, going back to, I think of two touchstones in creating worship, and that is building trust and having self-awareness. And self-awareness includes awareness of who's in the room, what are the needs, and knowing that there's a lot of diversity in the room, and that as worship leaders and creators, we have to think of it all. We have to think about the person with PTSD. We have to think about the person who loves to dance. We have to think about the person who is primarily intellectually engaged. We have to think about the person for whom Bach is their spiritual mentor, and we have to think about the person for whom, you know, Bruce Springsteen makes them weep. So that is the beauty and the challenge of creating worship in a Unitarian Universalist setting. And I think that if you read our new book, you will find the answer.
Where were you going to go with your question? Is that Kiama?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
Oh, such a long time. All the way from the Virgin Islands. There you go.
I'm Kiama Rockman. I'm the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of St. Croix in the Virgin Islands. 5 years ago when I came to the fellowship, prayer was not on the liturgy, on the order of service, and I inserted it. So for maybe 3 years or so, we included that, and then I began to do prayer / meditation / reflections, and I realized I still wasn't speaking to the theological reflections. So, and I wasn't doing education. So the way we do it now is we have silence, and I say this is the time for each of us uniquely to commune with that which is sacred and holy in their lives in whatever way you desire to do. Then I move into a spoken prayer. So it's been a growth experience for me, recognizing the need to do education, but also to educate myself so that I was honoring the diverse theologies in the congregation. Thank you.
That's great. That's very helpful. We're at the end of our time, and as you know, there'll be another workshop in here in half an hour. So some of us have to leave really quickly because we're going to lead another workshop immediately hereafter, but others of us will hang out for a few minutes and maybe engage with any questions that you might have that didn't get answered. Thanks so much to our panelists for coming today and being part of this. Thank you for being part of it.
Your point about the structure, that's absolutely right.